Thank you, Madeleine. I'm sure John will have some will have a response and some observations, but rather than keeping the discussion up here, I want to stretch choice to recent Fabian publications as a better choice of choice, and that lies with you. Rather than keeping the discussion up here, I would very much like to hear questions from the floor to any of the speakers, really. We have two microphones, roaming microphones, both on the left and right. So if you raise your arm and indicate whether you have a question, we're very happy to keep the discussion going. So let's start there, over there.
Yeah, I'd like to just comment on Madeleine's last point, and hopefully the other two panelists can come back on this, is what wasn't mentioned in the introduction was the shift from consumer society, as in consuming goods, or what was talked about a little bit was the idea of how it's understood in the Cold War period, as in how many cars per head of population have you got, versus what we have today when consumerism, or the idea of the consumer, is discussed in a far more broader fashion. We're we are consumers now of healthcare, or we are consumers of education, etc. So I was wondering if the members of the panel could come back and say, why is the idea of consumerism shifted away from the Adam Smith idea of, well, people produce stuff and everyone consumes that, to the idea that we are consumers of things that people never in the past understood as something you'd consume. Education would never be something that anybody would consume. So why has the debate shifted so much today?
Are there going to be other questions? Or?
Let's start with that one. I mean, I think we have got quite a lot on the plate about the moral dimension, the loss of the moral dimension, where the global fits in, and now why this extension of the consumer in that particular period.
Well, look, I'm not an expert on globalization, nor indeed about the neoliberalism particularly, but I will say a few things. First of all, I don't actually agree altogether with Jeff about, as it were, the evacuation of moral meaning of consumption. I mean, you know, that there is actually a vast body of literature that goes on, bangs on and on about the vices of consumption. Of course, it doesn't affect what goes on in the boardrooms of advertising agencies, but you wouldn't expect it to. And it's more, I think, that Madeleine's right, that there is this, that there is, has always been especially in periods of which ostensibly appear to be abundant, deep anxiety. I mean, you know, you go back to classical civilization, it's there. You know, the luxury debate is there in ancient Rome. There's a kind of ambiguity about the circumstances of finding yourself in these circumstances, and I think that this that there is a relationship. I mean, anxiety about abundance is a luxury itself, which we can afford. You don't find much anxiety about abundance in societies of real scarcity. It is essentially, just as you do not find the same kind of sentimentalism about, you know, thinking about a kind of order which somehow was in the past, which was static. You know, stillness is an obsession of modernity, precisely because we have such a strong sense of our own movement. These are sort of fantasies about what could be the case. So I think that you know, anxieties about, for instance, we'll hear more about this later on, about overeating or whatever, and about, you know, the body and so on, are very much a part of that particular set of circumstances. I don't about choice. I think it's very interesting that if you go back and remember the egregious Milton Friedman and Free to Choose. And Friedman, what's interesting about Friedman is that he doesn't say, that it's having lots of automobiles that creates democracy. He says that it's the right to choose to have automobiles, which is the great sign of a democracy. And the fetish of choice, I think, grows out of the neoliberalism of the 1980s. So that, and the connection, the mass society literature is much less, or the literature in the earlier period, as this questioner said, is much less. It's not terribly preoccupied with the issue of choice. It's preoccupied with the issue of provision, primarily, I think, and that's a shift. Why New Labour should have, fetishized choice in the way that it does is an answer that I cannot provide. Though it is true that one of the things of the 80s is that both the left and the right seem to have both incorporated this idea of choosing. It's and this sort of rhetoric about everybody as a consumer. What's very interesting about that? I mean, some people have argued that rhetoric is a whitewashing of capitalism. When the chairman of Unilever says, there used to be the working class and the middle class, and there used to be the council house owner and the private owner and so on. But now everybody's the same. We're all consumers. So, I mean, in that sense, it is very explicitly a denial of difference. I mean, it's a denial of the differences of access and so on. It's a rhetorical tactic that precludes dealing with these issues. Now, and that's one, I think, one of the most interesting aspects. I didn't say this in the talk, but if you think back to Galbraith in the 50s and the affluent society, one of the most interesting aspects of, and this is also borne out by work on the Industrial Revolution, is that you get, on the one hand, you get this sort of sense of or evidence of a certain amount of, in general, a greater affluence, but at the same time, you get greater inequality. And indeed, Elizabeth Cohen's book is partly about that. And so, the claim, so that there is a tension between the claims that somehow free market abundance, free market liberalism will provide for all, and this issue about equality, which of course is what the political debate becomes. But as I say, what I want to do is step outside that debate and see what each side is trying to do in making these kinds of claims. I mean, of course, as a citizen, I have views about all of that, but I'm also at the same time trying to establish some sort of distance in order to see how the terms operate. And in the case of Naomi Klein, finally, briefly, I think Jeff mentioned actually examples, an example of the ways in which there have been consumer movements in the past that are concerned with issues about production. I think you mentioned the French example of
critics of department stores who were arguing.
No, I was thinking more of people who connect, who are saying, well, we won't buy goods that are manufactured in this particular kind of way. If Klein is, I mean, obviously the terrain is, it seems to be different, although, I mean, globalization is a grossly exaggerated phenomenon in my view. But the connection between every cliche that you hear, you should always immediately interrogate. The connection, making the connection between consumption and production is not a kind of new link by any means. It's been made in the past by consumer movements on a number of occasions, I think. Isn't that right?
Yeah, can I just illuminate that one point, if I can, Frank, which is that what the Ligue Sociale d'Acheteurs in France did, but also what the social Catholic critics of department stores said, was that you are destroying the basis for sound, family-based moral production by going over to by buying from shops that exploit certain kinds of labour which are going to destroy the society. So those connections are made. What is interesting is they're made particularly strongly through Catholic discourse. And the fact that it goes on in Catholic countries like France and Belgium more than in Britain in that way might itself be worth thinking about.
Just briefly on that point about why would New Labour be so interested in extending the use of the word consumer to cover things like health and education. Well, you could take a very cynical view, the sort of view that a colleague like George Monbiot on The Guardian would do, which is that it unhitches the production and consumption. So the idea of education and health being deeply kind of collaborative, collective endeavours is dismantled, and your purpose is simply to consume, and therefore whoever is providing the service it is less important. I mean, it could be, you know, an American health company or a South African health company, which is precisely what New Labour is now doing. Who actually produces that service is then, it's simply a matter of, as a consumer, you are entitled to the best value for money. And if it's a South African company doing so and sorting out your cataract, then that's all fine. So it's, if you change the language, then I think you open up various political possibilities. And you could argue that New Labour's closeness to big business meant that there was a certain amount of pressure on New Labour to enable that kind of privatisation of state services. So I think you could argue there's a sort of political agenda there. I'd be quite sympathetic to that kind of argument.
There's been one person very patient over there. I've seen the other hands.
You're talking about me, Frank. But I was one thing. Say who I am, Michael Redcliffe. And one thing that struck me that I wasn't entirely surprised it was absent from John Burroughs' lecture, and I think some of it came through in the commentaries, but I would have thought was critical in any kind of distinction over time, and that is the importance today, in many people's view, of natural limits. You know, we're actually, it's not simply a question of self-loathing, important as that may be for many people, and perhaps many people here. There's this idea that was generated, first of all, in the 70s, you had the kind of limits to growth idea, that there wouldn't be enough resources to share, and to some extent that was not the case, for reasons we could go into but won't do here. But then, you know, in this global warming world, what we have is a whole set of issues around whether there are actually objective natural limits, whether in fact our own consumption, both collectively and individually, as it were, in all the forms it takes, isn't pressing at the limits of human reproduction. And that's a central issue, and it's one of the issues I would have thought behind the objections, some of the anti-globalization movement, of course, but also in a moral sense, in a sense that we do hold the future as important and that we are stakeholders in that future. So I don't think it's just the morality of yesterday or the morality of, you know, being a good Christian or a good citizen. Surely there's a real question about the limits within which consumption can be managed and handled, and there are various different positions on that. But I think that is a critical point, and I'd be interested to know, for example, what all the speakers, but particularly John Brewer, what he thinks about the historical sort of background to that. I mean, is there any kind of parallel, or are there any kind of issues in the past which in any way echo what we find today?
I want to take a few more, John. Let's take Tim Lang was very patient, and then we move over to the other side. Tim.
Tim Lang, City University. I'd like to pile on the agony that Michael Redcliffe's just, I hope, delivered.
That's what I thought, and that's why we passed the mic to you. Yes.
I think there are two major things that we're missing. I enjoyed your talk immensely, by the way. It was marvellous, I thought. But there was, and I liked the deconstruction of the ideas and what historians have been doing, but I thought Madeleine Bunton actually posed a very correct analysis when you were raising the issue of what does New Labour, how does it stand, and has it fudged the issue of whether consumers are actors or passive, which I think it has fudged, I agree with you. And I think historians have colluded in that fudging by, strangely, in the modern last 30 years of thinking about consumption and trying to unpick the history of consumption, consumerism, consumer society, they've ignored the state. And that's the hidden agency. That the political movements that Jeff was quite right to raise and I disagree with you, I don't think they just have been in the Catholic societies. There is an immensely powerful tradition in Britain from the 18th century of resisting industrialization and the consumption that went with industrialization, from Blake, William Morris, the cooperative movement you rightly alluded to, the 1840s, it began in the 1820s in Brighton originally, but is known and most associated with Rochdale now in the 1840s. That tradition actually needs to be brought into the discourse, to use that word, about consumption and consumerism. And it's not. It's seen as being about politics. In fact, there's a very noble and honourable and long tradition of action about consumption and consumerism that has been explored by historians, but it hasn't been connected with the modern discourse about consumers and consumerism. And it's poised to, and it needs to, because they are extremely rich traditions that aren't being connected. And so the missing factor, I think, in your presentation, in your lecture, was the role of the state, the role of institutions at mediating the market, determining how consumers can consume, and battles over what the state is and what it's there to do. And that, it seems to me, is immensely important as a watcher of what historians do, that you need to now connect, historians need to now connect those two traditions.
Thanks, Tim. John, do you want to?
You had a second thing that was missing, but you didn't tell me.
Let's stick to the let's stick to the stage.
All right, but yeah. Well, it's funny because one of the things that I was thinking about when writing one of the versions of this paper was that one of the reasons why stuff on the 18th century has been particularly interesting is because in certain respects it seems like it's consumerism pre consumer politics. Which isn't to say that there aren't forms of state regulation and so on, which are important. And I agree completely. I did actually make a brief allusion at the very end when I was talking about, you know, how we, as it were, painted back into this white, you know, it's like that blue room or something that they have in movies that actors are in or whatever, or a white screen. I mean, painting back in, as it were, all the bits between, as it were, the white, the screen itself and this one actor, the consumer. I mean, putting those pieces back in, and of course a crucial part of that would be, I did mention in passing, I mean, I'm sorry, but 40 minutes, a lot to cover. That's my excuse, but I agree.
I have quite a long queue which has built up. So choice only for people in that area. And we start, there's a gentleman in the back and then a bit forward and you.
Lawrence Baxter, Consumers Association. Certainly I'd like to, I welcome this debate here, and certainly what I think is quite a good historical treatise on the development of the consumer movement. Mentioning the development of the consumer movements and also of consumerism. I think from a perspective of the Consumers Association, I work in as a sort of policy advisor in personal finances. And so I certainly take well the comment made earlier about the importance of consumer debt. I have a couple of statements and then a question. From a perspective, looking at personal debt, the important rising, burgeoning personal debts and limited savings, it is in sort of increasing. There is, in a sense, some increasing public resonance in this debate, which also draws attention to the fact that there are. I mean, the public is becoming increasingly interested in it. Though, from talking about personal finances products, one of the things I see day to day is the overwhelming complexity of the products on offer, which makes consumer choice increasingly difficult. The issues of like transparency and actually helping consumers decide what they actually are buying or signing up to are increasingly important. The influence of the mass media I'm particularly interested in, and I would hope that Madeline would certainly cast light on that. Does it, to what extent do you think that the mass media does have an influence in raising attention of consumerism or consumer issues? I think that's, I'd quite like to have some discussion on that. And also, more generally from the panel, some discussion on this issue of increasing complexity of products in general and its impact on consumer choice. Thank you very much.
As the mic is moving down this side to the gentleman with the curly hair, I should take the opportunity to draw your attention that in January we'll actually have a leading American speaker on consumer credit card finance and consumer debt or addiction to debt, as it's called in Britain these days. But we take two more and then Madeleine and others can respond.
Certainly John Brewer's call for more differentiated studies of the consumer as opposed to stereotypical versions of consumers is to be welcomed upon a practical score. But then I ask myself whether his concluding remarks don't convey a too optimistic vision of kind of a Laplacian demon that could look at the consumers and spell out every single one. So I ask myself, if not the versions of stereotypical consumers don't exemplify a version of dealing with the consumers that is inherent, somewhat intrinsic in every approach to the consumer. Even if I study consumer societies, economically conscious consumers, is it not always the attempt to define a certain model of consumption? So is not the, let's say, Frankfurt School-inspired model of consumption just this dialogue between consumerism or a version of consumerism and actual consumption? Didn't Herbert Marcuse's writing actually influence individual choices of consumption? So is it rather that we can we really hope to become more differentiated, or don't we have to be more theoretical about our approach to models of consumption rather than the actual empirical consumer?
And I also take, we take two more because she can't see you, so.
I'm Sally Alexander, and I just wanted to just complicate New Labour's the language of choice in New Labour's is, you know, political speech discourse today. I know I'm not the only woman in this room who will recall the radical movements of the 1960s and 70s and the anxious debates about choice. As well as rights and a woman's right to choose, not just whether or not she has a child, but you know, all sorts of wants, to choose among wants. And the women's movement was only one of the radical movements. Then, of course, I'm only telling you what you all already know in this room, but you've only got to go back to old Labour itself to hear Aneurin Bevin saying that what he wanted in the 1940s was for people to want more and to be more educated about what they wanted. So the language of choice really doesn't only come from neoliberalism and big business.
Important issue. Let's take these. And Madeleine, do you want to?
Just, I think, very briefly on the issue, is the media interested in consumer issues? I think it's quite straightforward that when there's a big scandal, they're always interested. You know, if it can be very clear-cut that some dastardly deed is going on, then they'll splash it all over the front pages of the paper. Whether they play a more useful role than that in terms of educating consumers, 5 out of 10 maybe. I mean, I think they see certain sections of The Guardian have taken on a sort of brief of kind of informing consumers. beyond that, I think the interest wanes, really. Do the Guardian think about how they can inform people about the best pension to take? No, probably not. You know, we probably don't do nearly enough on pensions, along with, you know, lots of other parts of the media, which is its extremely important issue, which bores everybody. So, sorry, I might only be talking about myself, but I find it rather hard to get my head around pensions. But anyway, that I'd probably say we're sort of 5 out of 10.
Can I just add something? I think what's very interesting on this issue of complexity and consumer education, and it strikes me, is that groups who represent the consumer are in some ways absolutely complicit in the issue of complexity, precisely because they spend a lot of time educating people in order to understand complexity rather than, say, resisting complexity. So there is a way, I mean, I'm very struck when I listen to consumer programs on the radio about how, you know, you're creating this kind of, you know, informed, supposedly rational consumer, and in one sense you can see it's desirable, given that the system works in the way that it does, that one should be as well informed as possible. But on the other hand, it buys into the increasing complexity. I mean, to be a consumer is increasingly complex in that way.
So maybe you should stop offering people advice.
We have three more, the gentleman in the very back, and then there's one on the side here and in the front, please.
Yes, I enjoyed the debate so far, but I just wanted to challenge the panel. You talked about the whole issue of anxiety and morals around consumers, but you forgot to mention two major consumer movements. Basically, the consumer movement around slavery and civil rights. In terms of slavery, the movement was in terms of chattel labour, in terms of black people who were forced from Africa to the Caribbean, to Americas, and what happened particularly in America and in Britain around the whole counter and anti-slavery movement, which involved both black and white people fighting against that whole issue and people resisting in the plantations. So that was one massive consumer movement. You know, you might not see it that way, but it was. And the second movement was around civil rights and how it started with Rosa Parks in America, where she refused to get off the bus. And that was a massive consumer movement which had a major impact, which has a psyche on American life since then. And I think it's raised that issue about the morality of what is a consumer and the whole issue of discrimination of consumers in society.
In the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, there was an interview with an American spokeswoman for, I think it was called the American Heritage Foundation, and she said, it sounded like a deranged comment at the time, that it was a fundamental human right for people in California to own a sports utility vehicle. And you'd think it was deranged, and then you realize she's probably speaking on behalf of 150, 200 million people. And then I started to think, well, maybe it's me as well. And it seemed to me that in your talk that, and I came in late, so I may have missed it, there was this kind of a broad sweep through history, the history of consumption and cultures of consumption, but that you may have missed the single most important factor, which is the disjunction that has happened in the last 50 years, where the quantum of consumption and its impact is absolutely unprecedented. There are 6 billion of us wanting SUVs. I mean, tell it to the people of Bangladesh that it's a fundamental human right. And that the impact of that far outweighs any historical precedent. It goes beyond in terms of, a gentleman over here was talking about natural limits, but the whole psychology of it and the impact it has on the world economy, where we want to live, migration, climate change, politics, and that you've not, I don't think, really touched on that. I'm sorry if that sounds critical.
Can we take one more on the very front of this?
This is going to sound like I've just synchronised with the gentleman who's stopped speaking. My name's Mario Minichiello. I've just completed, I'm probably going to throw a spanner in the works somewhat, because it's a strange question, but it does link to that, in that I've just finished the Afghanistan reportage project about the Afghanistan war, which is funded by HRB. And I just think it's extraordinary that while I'm doing the artwork at the same time, I kind of graze the news because it's always on in the background as I'm producing things. And one of the things that filtered through as I was doing this was the idea that I think came from New Scientist, that if we carry on consuming in the West to the rate that we are, we're going to need another three planets. And the other thing that also filtered through on some Five Live program was Jermaine Greer becoming very upset when somebody suggested that our consumption of the world is immoral. And at the same time, I'm doing artwork which features people who haven't even got clean drinking water while we're actually flushing our toilets with clean drinking water. And I think that somewhere there is a moral imperative. There is an incredible problem to do with not just our historical view of what makes us consumers, but our right to continue to consume in this way without any kind of moral brace.
Thank you. I should say you have plenty more time to ask the speakers directly at the reception, but I'm sure some of you will be getting thirsty. So I want to take this opportunity to give each speaker final opportunity to comment on the last few questions. Perhaps, Jeff, do you want to start?
Yeah, I just really to pick up on the politics line, which has come from two directions, one from Tim Lang, and then the point about anti-slavery and civil rights boycotts. I think that, Tim, you're absolutely right, that it is absolutely critical that we get the state and politics back into the discussion of what consumption is about, because in many ways the notion of the consumer is one that has been constructed by trying to evacuate that the state from that terrain. And thus, I think, the answer to the earlier question quite early on about why is consumer the term that's now used for education and health. And I'm pretty, in my mind, it's because it's the reference of consumer to markets that's a critical issue, rather than that we consume the health. Consumer is a nice neutral term to use for describing people in the market, and it's the market that much of these policies are about. But on politics, I think that there is, I agree, a rich tradition of political protest and action over consumer issues. That might, to correct a point, my point about the Catholic countries is that it links to production much more centrally, and it's that point wrong. And it may still be wrong, but that's the point I was trying to make there. But I think this rich tradition is absolutely crucial, particularly where it's not so much about consumer politics as about consumption, but actually about much bigger issues than consumption, that is actually about the whole shape of society and the economy. I'm less sure about that, but certainly the civil rights movement, where people in the American South, black people in the American South, were not fighting simply to be able to get on the buses they wanted to. It was using their consumer rights to fight over much, much bigger issues than that. And of course, those, you know, so everybody in this room has been involved in consumer boycotts, boycotts of Chilean goods or South African goods and so on. That this is the use of consumption as a political tool rather than a politics that is itself centrally about consumption. I think we need to distinguish the two, though both are important.
I want to just pick up the point that the gentleman over there was talking about and was raised here about the sort of natural limits to consumption. I've written about this in my column because I think this is a very, very problematic issue. Zygmunt Bauman, the sociologist, I think puts it beautifully, like he puts so much, when he says that the role for the poor is as failed consumers. They can't participate. They actually become nothing more than spectators of our wealth. I think that consumption and consumerism now has a global audience, because there are billions watching on television what we are consuming, and I find that myself deeply problematic. But I also feel that while many people in this room might find that equally problematic, it has no moral purchase on the national imagination or even the imagination of many developed countries. We simply don't make headway in getting people to address that this is deeply problematic. So any ideas about how that is possible to connect that? And I think Jeff raised the issue of only connect. How true does that seem? One other point that I would would say that I think is almost as important, it's not as important as that, but it's almost, is happiness economics. I think this is a really interesting one to sort of lob into the discussion, which is that there is a growing number of economists who are picking over a whole body of enormous amount of research to argue that the levels of happiness and well-being and satisfaction do not increase and actually begin at a certain point in the rise in GDP to fall off, that material wealth does not make us happy. Now, this is one of the oldest sort of wisdoms ever, but economists now, such as Robert Lane in America, are producing very, very powerfully argued books. And I think this is interesting because what we're beginning to understand is an agenda about mental illness, which I think is going to become a big issue. They say depression by WHO says depression will be the biggest disease in the world by 2020. And the sources of that unease with ourselves has some relationship to this debate. I know it's you know, it may seem a bit tangential, but it's related really. It's about the value of material wealth, the kinds of self-loathing that it engenders, and at the same time the fascination it exerts. And I think it's going to be a very interesting contribution that the happiness economists make, mainly because policymakers listen to them. And I find it very interesting that now we get Jeff Mulgan in the strategy unit producing life satisfaction reports, that the government is thinking about a well-being index. This is beginning to impact on policymaking, and I think that's going to be very interesting as well.
Well, I didn't really have. We've opened Pandora's box here, which you know, I thought that's enough.
Before you will be leaving for the reception, let me actually remind you that this is the final issue about the state and politics offers me golden opportunity to make a wonderful transition, because our next public lecture on the 17th of November will be about food wars, and there will be a lot of politics in it, and Tim Lang will deliver that lecture, and we'll have Lord Haskins, who's government advisor and former chairman of Northern Foods, as commentator, as well as Peter Jackson, a geographer who does wonderful work, innovative work on the food chain in the research program. But I want to thank again John Brewer for a very stimulating talk, which indeed opened up moral, political, as well as historical questions, and Jeff Krosigk and Madeline Bunting for comments, and you for a very interesting discussion. Thank you. The reception is in the room behind you. Thank you.